Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive functions. This show is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. These conversations will introduce mental tools that will empower you to shift your mindset for a successful life. And now, here's your host, Sucheta Kamath.
All right, this is Full Prefrontal. Welcome back. We're here to expose the mysteries of executive functions. I am here with our host, Sucheta Kamath. Good morning, Sucheta. Always good to be with you. So, you know, as we record this, I'm broadcasting from Chicago, and we're all big fans of William the Refrigerator Perry. He was on the Super Bowl champion Bears in 1986. Today, we're going to talk about the fridge. We're going to talk about his Super Bowl ring and self-reflection. Tell me more.
Well, thank you for that introduction, Todd. Guess, I don't know if you know, but debt, disease, drugs, divorce, and death are some of the reasons why people sell their championship ring.
Yeah.
And you're right. I am going to talk about William the Refrigerator Perry, who you nicely introduced was a superstar. Unfortunately, he in 2008 got diagnosed with Guillain-Barré syndrome, where the body's immune system attacks part of the peripheral nervous system, which is extremely debilitating condition. So a 10-year-old boy from Pittsburgh, his name is Cliff Forrest, saw the ring, this championship ring, at a Mickey Mantle restaurant in New York City for sale. And he really, really wanted it. So what he did, which is going to blow your mind, is he took out $8,500 out of his college fund without his dad's approval, but approval from his mom, and bought the championship ring. Eventually, once he had it in his possession, he read a little bit more about the fridge and found out about his disease. And that really touched his heart. And he gave a little thought to it. And he was so moved by it that he kind of urged his parents and he said to his dad that, can I please give this ring back to him since he is going through rough times. And of course, Perry was so grateful for that. And he gave the little boy two autographed jerseys that read, "The fridge, thanks." So there's no doubt that the most powerful human organ in the brain is certainly equipped with many power tools that help us navigate through daily decisions and learning from mistakes. The prefrontal system in the brain operates like a remote control, letting us fast forward to the future, rewind back to the past, to revisit things that haven't worked out well. And most importantly, it lets you pause for reflection. This boy in the story, you know, Cliff, really reflected on the situation that Perry was going through. And with great thoughtfulness, he returned the ring back to William Perry, the refrigerator. And so learning ways to use the pause button turns out to be a lifelong commitment. And today, our guest, a very special person, Dr. Stephanie Carlson, is going to talk about this very specific thing. She is a distinguished McKnight University professor and director of research at the Institute of Child Development, University of Minnesota, the number one ranked department for developmental psychology, as we have found out. And Dr. Carlson is an internationally recognized leader in the study of executive function. She has developed innovative ways of measuring executive function in very young children and has made discoveries about the role of executive function in other important aspects of human development. Dr. Carlson's current research focuses on the ways to promote executive function through physical health, which is such as nutrition and sleep, caregiving practices, and preschool curricula. Her work has been supported by the National Institute of Health, Institute of Education Sciences, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, John Templeton Foundation, just to name a few. Dr. Carlson is a fellow of the American Psychological Association and the Association for Psychological Sciences. She serves on several editorial boards and is a vice president of the Jean Piaget Society, and is a member of the Human Capital and Economic Opportunity Global Working Group. So her work has been featured in several media outlets, including the New York Times, the New York Times Magazine, National Public Radio, etc. I'm very thrilled to have her on the show today.
Yeah, no, it promises to be a fascinating conversation with Dr. Carlson. And I'm still touched by your story about William Perry and that child. I mean, just Although those, unfortunately, those stories about athletes such as him going through post-stardom struggles is unfortunately very, very common. What a great story. All right. Well, let's get to this conversation with Sucheda and Dr. Stephanie Carlson.
Welcome to the podcast, Stephanie. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
So before I get started, I wanted to ask you about your interest in executive function. How did you come into this field, or what piqued your interest?
Well, actually, I was trying to solve a different problem. I was in graduate school, and I was interested in the development of theory of mind. So that is the development of the ability to take somebody else's perspective. And that's really important for things like peer relations and conflict resolution. And it's just a basic developmental milestone to be able to take somebody else's perspective. And we and many, many researchers and well-respected researchers around the country and, in fact, the world were puzzling over this problem of why is it that young children have such difficulty taking somebody else's perspective and fail these laboratory tasks that have been designed to measure the ability to take someone else's point of view. So through my research in graduate school, I came to think about some child characteristics, other aspects of development that might be really important for this ability to develop, and started to investigate the development of executive function. And so this refers to the development of self-control, including the ability to control your thoughts, your feelings, and your actions or behaviors. So it was really in the service of solving a different problem that I started to look at how difficulties or the slowness of the development of executive function might be, in fact, what's hindering children's ability to acquire theory of mind.
Oh, I did not know that. That is such a cool story. I can completely understand how that executive function goes into perspective-taking process, but also once you develop, so you regulate yourself, but you eventually regulate your relationship with others and regulate your responses in social context. And to regulate that in social context, you need a huge understanding of or have developed theory of minds. That is really wonderful. So you already defined what executive function means. So when do these skills emerge in children? Or can you explain how they are progressive in nature and they don't, all of those components don't develop simultaneously? So how do you see them?
Well, so we see the very nascent beginnings of the development of executive function in infancy. And even a young infant, 4 months of age, who can't speak or crawl or apparently do much of anything yet, they can control things like turning their head away from something that's sort of bothering them, like a sibling that's kind of poking at them or something like that. They can, they self-regulate in a deliberate way, and that becomes increasingly more and more conscious and intentional. And, you know, then we see the progression to toddlers who are starting to get some conscious control over their thoughts and feelings and actions. And some of the tantrums that you see in toddlerhood are a sign of this struggle that they're, that the inner struggle that they're having to deal with strong feelings, having really strong feelings and being unable to have total control over the environment or the situation, or to have whatever they want right now. So you see that kind of gradual development, getting emotions under control. And with preschoolers, it develops even further to where they have the ability to kind of reflect more and realize that they have, you know, maybe multiple ways of solving a problem, or that they have choices in how to act, think, or feel. And that reflection feeds into this ability to, you know, make better choices and delay gratification and maybe postpone some kind of temptation for later, so that they can have maybe the larger reward later. So all of these things are kind of building from infancy through toddlerhood and into the preschool period. And they involve both kind of everyday sorts of problems where there's not really a reward at stake, or, you know, it's just kind of an everyday problem that's at hand. Or sometimes it involves really high stakes, or something that feels really high stakes to the child, like, you know, a reward that they're trying to wait for. And it feels like the end of the world if they can't have it right now.
Got it. So this, as you mentioned, in the early years, when it starts with some intentional control, some kind of tinge of that. And then as they progress and develop, you become more control of your intentions, thoughts, as well as actions. And then you start influencing your outcome. How does that help? So executive function have been shown to have great implications for developmental outcomes, not just limited to the school readiness, but even later life and social functioning, overall welfare, well-being. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so there's a growing body of evidence to suggest that early individual differences in executive function and self-regulation have long-term consequences for academic and school success, as well as health, wealth, and well-being. So my students and colleagues and I are interested in investigating, you know, just how that works, how that pathway or those pathways can work. So I think that individual differences in executive function, even though, so I should just back up a little bit and say that even though there is this really, you know, predictable set of milestones in the development of executive function that we all go through, at least typically developing individuals will go through, there are also really big individual differences at any age. So we kind of capitalize on that by looking at relatively good versus poor executive functioning, and then in turn, how is that related to academic or other aspects of life success and achievement? And I think it could be direct, the sort of to the extent that there is a causal pathway, it could be direct. So, for example, paying attention. So being able to attend, especially for long periods of time, and to sit still is, you know, an important aspect of executive function. It's the one manifestation of executive function. And that is going to be important for being able to learn things in a school environment or a school setting. So taking in information, working with it in your mind, so that's called working memory, and being able to retain information and, you know, use it again in the appropriate context or execute on it in another context or transfer your learning from one context to another. All of that resting on executive function skills could be kind of a direct pathway for how these skills influence learning. But there could also be a lot of indirect ways in which executive function influences these outcomes. So by, as we discussed earlier, having stronger peer relations. When you have stronger peer relations and you feel more sort of effective or efficacious at school, school's a more positive experience for you. If teachers like you, and we do know from quite a bit of research that teachers do prefer children with higher executive function skills, they're easier to teach. They're, you know, more attentive. But then, you know, when teachers like you better, you like school better. And all of these things can have a cascading effect on the individual child's kind of learning environment and, you know, ultimately their success in a school setting. So both direct and indirect effects could be at play here.
I see. When we talked last time, you said something very insightful. You said executive function is most conspicuous when lacking. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And how does that play in, you mentioned that already in the classroom, but in terms of that child's own ability to take control of his own learning, that can really set him back if he doesn't have these capacities, right?
Yeah, for sure. So most executive function is most conspicuous in its absence. And so you sort of see it when it's not there. Most obviously. So when children or students are lacking in the ability to hold information in mind, to control their impulses, and when they're lacking in the ability to think flexibly or to be reflective on their thoughts, actions, or feelings, we notice it. And so we notice it because they're more likely to act out in class. Or, you know, importantly, another manifestation of low executive function could be a student who actually flies under the radar, not acting out in class, but is really not following what's going on because, you know, in part because they're lacking some of these key attention and self-control skills. So it actually could go either way with acting out or going unnoticed, you know, but typically we think of this sort of more ADHD end of the continuum of a classic executive function impairment, but it is a continuum. So even children with mild deficits or delays in executive function can begin to experience school failure at a very young age. So that's why a lot of our intervention efforts have been focused on children who, for one reason or another, just don't have a leg up on the development of these skills to the same extent that their peers might.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Like, why is mild impairment also causes disruption in that learning progress versus severe? Why does that show it like that?
Well, so again, I think there could be both direct and indirect things at play. So let's say you're learning to read and you have relatively poor working memory. So it's not anything that has, you know, caught the attention of a kindergarten screening or has been, you know, an obvious difficulty requiring an IEP, but you have relatively low working memory. It's harder for you to retain the information from the beginning of a sentence to the end of a sentence. Or from the beginning of a passage to the end of a passage, you might have to reread it multiple times. But if you don't have the strategies to know that that's what's going on and the reflection ability to realize that, oh, I just got through a whole page and I don't really understand what I just read, I should probably go back and reread it. If you don't have that reflective capacity, which is a major part of executive function, you're unlikely to take that step. That metacognitive step of going back and rereading the sentence or the passage. And instead, you just continue on not fully comprehending the text. So that's just an example of how even mild difficulties in this area can really accumulate over time to where you're not reading at grade level, for example.
Yeah, that makes sense. So many researchers describe hard versus cool executive function. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I alluded to this earlier where, you know, sometimes we need to consciously control our thoughts, actions, and feelings in many different ways kind of throughout the day. We also self-regulate in a lot of non-conscious ways throughout the day too, like our digestion and our breathing and, you know, heart rate and so forth. So executive function is like those other aspects of self-regulation in many ways, but it's also very much unlike it in that by definition, executive function is conscious and deliberate. So it's when something that we need to regulate is effortful, is kind of when we engage our executive function skills, which are largely associated with prefrontal cortex. But occasionally, you might be solving a problem where it's a math problem, and normally you solve it one way, like you've learned one routine for how to solve this problem or one operation, like addition. And now you're faced with a new operation or you're trying to learn something new, like multiplication. If you continue on with the old way of how you work with these numbers, you're going to get the answer wrong. So like you've learned addition and you've learned that, you know, 3 + 3 = 6, but now you're switching to multiplication and it's a different operation. You have to think about 3 × 3 instead, and you would get a different answer. And that's a relatively cool situation. So unless it's maybe a math test or something where, you know, you're kind of feeling like stressed and like the stakes are high, it's a relatively cool situation where you are just thinking through this problem and there's no reward at stake. There's no maybe high or intense emotional setting or context associated with it. So we call that cool executive function. And we measure that in kids and adults actually with task switching measures. So, for example, something that we developed called the Minnesota Executive Function Scale is a cool executive function task where kids using a tablet game, they have to sort cards by one dimension, like their color. And then they, after a few trials of doing that, they're told to switch and sort those same cards by their shape. And it's a challenge because you have to hold in mind this new rule. You have to inhibit or suppress the old rule. And you have to switch flexibly from the one way of playing this game or thinking about this game to a new way of thinking about the same game. But again, you know, there's no real high stakes or emotion involved. So those are cool measures, or cool EF or executive function. With hot executive function, the difference is that the context is more emotional somehow. So there's a reward at stake or there's some kind of heated emotion. It's sort of like in the heat of the moment when you have to make a decision and use your executive function skills, that we call that hot executive function. So the marshmallow test, kind of a classic delay of gratification test, test like that would be an example of hot executive function.
Got it. So this happened to me recently. I was flying back from New Mexico and our flight was on the runway and we were getting delayed because the weather just was not cooperating. And the person sitting in next seat across the aisle started huffing out loud. The more announcements the flight attendant man made, more audible his huffing got. I mean, he must have been in his late 50s. And the last third time when she came out, he slammed the book that he was reading and he stomped his feet just like a child. That's kind of not tolerating the emotional burden. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly. And we, I mean, these are the sort of most fun measures to use in the lab because kids really do the funniest things. So we do the marshmallow test quite often. And in fact, what kids do in that situation to regulate themselves has inspired a whole line of research that my students and I have done. And so what we noticed, so, you know, kids do really funny and different things to try to endure the delay where they're faced with a marshmallow or whatever tempting treat they've chosen, and they have to wait for the experimenter to come back. And if they wait, they can have two marshmallows or, you know, whatever the larger reward is. So it's very tempting and it's very difficult, especially for some children more than others, those individual differences again. But what helps some children succeed is that they spontaneously engage in strategies. So they might, for example, start singing to themselves. One child started singing. He made up a song called I'm Waiting. And you know, just kind of went into this sort of rap routine about waiting. It was really cute. And some children will, it's kind of like know thyself. Like if you know that this is going to be tough for you, this is going to be a tough situation, you can, you know, some children will engage in these spontaneous strategies. Like one child just turned around in her chair. And she knew that by not having a line of sight on the marshmallow, that she would be able to delay gratification longer. And then, you know, we had another child named Jane who started talking to herself during the delay. And she was reminding herself of the rules, but she used the third person, which we thought was really interesting. She had just turned three. And she said, Jane wants to eat those raisins. So she had chosen raisins for her treat. Jane wants to eat those. Jane wants to eat those raisins. Is Jane going to eat them? And then she said, if she has one, because you could have one raisin now. Then she said, then Jane's not going to have all of these. And she pointed to the larger reward. And then she said, because she might choke. So she's kind of working it out in her mind and coming up with a rationale for why she shouldn't have the one raisin now. So that actually inspired a whole line of research where we thought it was so interesting that she used the third person. And what that does is it sets up a little bit of psychological distance from the self. And, you know, we know that is helpful for things like emotion regulation. And this is an example of a hot executive function task, like I mentioned. But when you, it's so much easier, like, for example, to help somebody else, a friend or a family member, through an emotional problem, you know, emotional upset that they might be having. Because for you, you're not immersed in it. You know, for you, you have a little bit more perspective. You've got more of a bird's eye view on the situation. It's easier for you to see the choices that this person has before them for how to overcome this challenge. And so it's the same kind of thing. We thought maybe what she's doing here is making it a little bit easier for herself by distancing. And so we, in turn, my students and I collaborated with Angela Duckworth and Ethan Cross, and we applied for a grant together and were successful in that. And did a series of studies to show that in both children and adults, this psychological distancing can be very effective for improving performance in both cool EF and hot EF contexts.
And you have also seen that there's applicability of this research in older children, right? So once you teach this self, or rather, do you teach self-distancing, or they, when they strategize on their own, it's much more effective?
It was, seeing them do it on their own, that was really inspiring. And then what we did is to instruct children. So we randomly assigned children, and we've studied children from ages 3 to 6 so far on this. And the five and 6 year olds kind of most reliably show this effect that we call it the Batman effect, because what we suggest to be the most distanced from the self is to pretend to be a character, an exemplary character who is really good at games like these, or somebody who has really good self-control. And so Batman is one example. It's one of the options that they have available to them when we ask them like which character they want to be while they play this game. And what we've found in several studies is that when children are pretending to be Batman or whatever exemplary or competent character they've chosen to pretend to be while performing an executive function task, they will perform as if they're as much as a year older. So for example, five-year-olds will perform on the task as if they were six-year-olds under normal conditions. So we call that the Batman effect. And what we're doing now is to just try to understand more about this effect and what's influencing it. So do the qualities of the character matter, and how do they matter? Do some children benefit from this strategy more than others? Those are the kinds of questions that we're investigating now.
Well, thank you so much for your in-depth explanation and helping us understand this very fascinating topic. Before I end my interview, if people want to find out more about your research or reach you, what's the best way they can get hold of you?
Yeah, there are two ways to reach me. One is through the University of Minnesota Institute of Child Development, and I have a joint lab there with Professor Phil Zelazo, and you could reach me through my lab, or my email is smc@umn.edu. And then Reflection Sciences is a company that Phil and I developed in order to share and disseminate more information about executive function to educators and parents, and to provide tools for assessing it and professional development for ways to learn more about it. And so that's reflectionsciences.com.
Well, thank you so much. We will attach all that information on our website. Once again, I'm immensely grateful for your time, and thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, we're back. That was Dr. Stephanie Carlson-Sucheda. A great conversation with Dr. Carlson. I learned an awful lot from her, as I typically do from your conversations. Any immediate thoughts about the conversation?
Absolutely, Todd. Truly, that was fantastic. The first takeaway for me is how deliberate the executive system is. The autonomic nervous system in humans is not under our conscious control. We cannot stop our heart from pumping blood, or pupils from dilating, stomach from digesting food, or the sweat glands from doing their job. But the executive system, on the other hand, is completely under our conscious control and is activated through deliberate effort. So I hope our listeners can take this away with them, that this ability of deliberate effort is what helps us turn away from dessert, stop ourselves from laughing when somebody trips on the sidewalk, and lets us bite our tongue even when we know our husband was utterly wrong. So executive function skills are present even in infancy, but at a very rudimentary way. I remember my son Kunal used to do this all the time when he was a baby. I would try to give him ground up baby food from a jar, and he would keep his lips tightly sealed, but quickly open the minute I would offer him something like homemade mashed potatoes or something like that. So we need to keep in mind that executive function progressively evolves, allowing children to self-regulate their thoughts and feelings and actions. And that's what Dr. Carlson was talking about. And her work, particularly with preschoolers, shows that they have the ability to reflect on behavior, evaluate choices for problem solving, and resist temptations for a larger benefit, but that's coming down the road in the future. And this helps them get their emotions under control, as well as shape their behavioral responses in various novel situations.
Well, I can also speak from personal experience that some wives cannot bite their tongue when their husbands are utterly wrong. So I've experienced that side.
I wonder if that's a problem with executive function or a problem with husband-wife relationship.
Oh, no, I think it's a problem with the husband, because he's probably utterly wrong a lot more often than is probably average. Any event, we'll move on from that discussion. So going back to your conversation with Dr. Carlson, the discussion also touched on how all of us all together, we have to become very intentional about teaching executive function, right?
Yeah, that's the second takeaway for all of us here, that it's not just parents and educators, but the whole society needs to be invested in learning how executive function and self-regulation develop, because the research shows that it has a strong bearing on long-range outcomes, including school success, job success, physical and mental health, marital harmony, as you were just talking about, and overall quality of life. And there's a clear and distinct individual differences as self-regulation, and they are often apparent as early as preschool age children, but the individual profile may be different. As Dr. Carlson was talking about, simple things like not being able to sit still in the class and not being able to pay attention or follow instructions, or not being able to abide by the class rules, particularly the invisible ones, can be a red flag. And eventually, that's what results in school failure. Not at all the child's intellectual capacity or ability to recite alphabet or do simple math problems. The very young age children, if they experience school failure, that can have a devastating impact and can have chronic effects that last for life. One of my previous podcast guests, Clancy Blair's research shows that in spite of same level of IQ, those with stronger executive function skills tend to do better on measures of math and literacy. So the concern is not just limited to the direct impact of poorly developing executive function and self-regulation, but indirect ones. And that's what Dr. Carlson was emphasizing. So I feel that impulsive, distractible, excessively chatty, disruptive children are those who are not with the program, so to speak, and they tend to become a classroom management challenge for teachers and educators. And they are less liked by the teachers, as well as they're hard to be coached. And then they tend to give hard time to their peers. And then in return, they become less inviting members of the classroom structure. So all in all, these kids are likely to get neglected and receive less respect in teaching and learning context. And as a result of that, they, of course, receive less support because of their own poor self-regulation. So it's a kind of a sad situation that poor self-regulation makes it not advocate for their difficulties, and not advocating for their difficulties makes it receive less help for their poor regulation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It just sounds like, Sucheta, that people who are raising and educating children with developmental disorders, they have to understand these issues very well, right?
Yeah, and that's my last takeaway here, that the development of executive function can be disrupted by many factors, including genetics and environmental stressors. And time and again, every guest that I have had has emphasized to really have a holistic approach to looking at that development. And Dr. Carlson was talking about the indirect effects that I just listed. But I myself see that in my practice, that many childhood disorders, such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, the spectrum disorders, conduct disorders, Tourette's syndrome, or even obsessive compulsive disorder, they all have a varying presentation of underlying executive function difficulties. Their individual profile may have some additional features specific to that disorder, but a unifying factor is poor self-regulation and poor executive function foundation. So now what happens is these skills that help you manage yourself don't emerge properly, and there is an underlying disability that makes them help themselves. So these children definitely get left behind. And I think these children who are not meeting the expectations, whether they're classroom work performance expectations, classroom behavioral expectations, or interpersonal peer relationship expectations, all in all, they are the ones who suffer the most.
Yeah, unfortunately. So before we wrap this conversation, Sucheta, any final thoughts on this conversation with Dr. Carlson?
Here's what I would say to our listeners, that I think keep a wide lens on learning and teaching, and be very pro-support of child's understanding of self. And that, as Dr. Carlson's research shows, is about self-reflection. And I think self-reflection can be a very big tool to understand one's own limitations and understand one's own inability of reflecting and recognizing challenges and roadblocks. But that reflection, which can be painful, will eventually become a path to success.
Yeah, no, good stuff. All right, it's all the time we have for today. On behalf of our host, Sucheta Kamath, and all of us at Cerebral Matters, thank you for tuning in and listening today, and we look forward to seeing you again next week on Full Prefrontal.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive functions. To contact our host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive functions, visit her website at CerebralMatters.com. That's CerebralMatters.com. Tune in next week for the next informative episode of Full Prefrontal.